you like this episode, please subscribe, share with others, rate and review so we can continue to bring you great programming.
Welcome to Inclusion Catalyst. We invite diversity leaders to the table to deconstruct complex social justice issues and showcase the best inclusion practices in our workplaces and our communities.
What's up, everybody? This is Julian Geiser from Great Heart Consulting. My pronouns are he, him, and you're listening to the Inclusion Catalyst podcast. The goal of each episode is to give people the tools and resources they need to create inclusive environments that truly reflect the diversity of our modern workforce. I sit down with various agents of change to discuss the ideas, the opportunities, and the strategies that need to be implemented to effectively bring change. Today on the show, we welcome Ruchika Tulshyan. Ruchika and I both identify as third culture kids. She's Singaporean and of Indian descent, and I'm Swiss and American. Today, in addition to talking about what it means to be third culture, we're also discussing a closely related concept, and what I came to learn is a bit of a soapbox for her. A not particularly veiled disdain for the concept of cultural competency, especially in the workplace. Whereas competency, in the context of navigating cultural differences, seems to reinforce the existent power dynamics at play and maintain the hierarchy of superiority of one culture over another, cultural humility introduces concepts of curiosity, mutual respect, and the equitable exchange of value as we grow and learn about other cultures. We'll get into that and more shortly. Ruchika is the author of Inclusion on Purpose, an intersectional approach to creating a culture of belonging at work. She's also the founder of Candor, an inclusion strategy practice. A former international business journalist, Ruchika is a regular contributor to the New York Times and Harvard Business Review. Ruchika co-wrote a paradigm-shifting article, Stop Telling Women They Have Imposter Syndrome, for Harvard Business Review with Jody Ann Burry. The article has over a million views, has been translated into multiple languages, and is one of HBR.org's top most 100 read articles in history, as well as the top three articles for the publication in 2021. Best of all, people all over the world have said it helped change their relationship with the concept of imposter syndrome. Ruchika's first book is The Diversity Advantage, Fixing Gender Inequality in the Workplace. Welcome, Ruchika, and thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me, Julian. Excited to have this conversation.
We're glad that you're here. And as we get started today, we've been doing this with each of the guests we've welcomed. I was hoping you might share some of the aspects of your identity that are most important to you.
Yeah, thank you. Well, you've probably touched upon a couple that are really important to me. I am Singaporean and of Indian descent. So that's something that I hold very dear to me. And because there are very few of us out that I meet in the world. So when I meet another Singaporean, I'm always very, very thrilled. I identify as a woman and a woman of color, which has been very formative to my experiences, certainly in the workplace, where, you know, is what I'm most interested in studying. What does power, what does inclusion, what does belonging, what does it mean to really, really feel like your voice is heard in the workplace? So that's what I like to study. And that's what I advise on. I'm based here in Seattle, and I've been here for 9 years. It's definitely the longest place I've now lived in outside of Singapore, which was a big surprise to me when we first moved here. My husband and I, at that time, when we first moved here, we just thought it would be, you know, temporarily for his job. But there's something very beautiful, very special about this place, which has kept us here. And now I'm also a mom to a 6-year-old son. And I'd say probably the other part of the identity of my identity, which I always like to talk about when I get a chance, and I don't as much in the workplace context, is I'm really, really, really interested in food. Hmm. And if when people ask me what my next career would be, you know, I would either love to own a restaurant or a sort of B&B, not Airbnb, but a B&B where we're serving great food.
Gotta make food.
Or a winery. So these are things that I'm very passionate about, and I would say quite important to my identity.
Nice. Well, thank you so much for sharing that. I'm really excited to talk with you about this idea of being third culture and how it relates to culture of humility. It's always felt like we talk a lot about intersectionality in D&I work. And what could be more intersectional than like two competing identities around culture and place and roots? So As we get started, I think it's really important that we set a little bit of context and share some technical definitions. So I'd like to do that for our listeners now, if you don't mind.
That sounds great, especially third culture kid, which actually, in all the years that I've been practicing DEI here in the United States, I can probably count on one hand the number of times people have mentioned the concept of third culture kid.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think it is an important distinction, because I think we talk a lot about multiculturalism, biculturalism, and I think that the distinction is critical. And I think one reason we talked about in our prep a little bit that I find that it's really important to think about is that I think there's an opportunity to engage people with that aspect of identity in D&I work, and really get them to be contributing members to more inclusive leadership, just because they tend to be natural bridge builders, because they've had to one way or another, whether it's keeping in touch with family that's abroad or navigating time zone differences or, you know, whatever the case may be. I think they tend to be natural bridge builders. So if listeners can't already tell, I'm excited about this conversation. I'm pretty invested in this idea, because it's a really central way that I've thought of myself and oriented myself in the world for a really long time. I think it wasn't a concept I was familiar with when I was younger, but I think by the time I was in my mid to late teens, it's a word that I came across. I was like, oh wow, like that really accurately describes my experience. And so some synonyms for third culture kids are cultural hybrids, global nomads, and cultural chameleons. And this classification is directly connected to a phenomenon we're all living with, which is globalization and mobility. And what differentiates a third culture kid from someone who might identify as bicultural or multicultural is that the movement between cultures happens when they're young, so before they've had a chance to fully go through their personal and cultural identity development. So this means that while over their lifetime, they might successfully integrate both cultures, or one at a time for a part of their life and then another, and feel at home in each, it's also likely that they might also feel like they kind of float between the two and not fully belong to either. So that's kind of the idea of being third culture in a nutshell. And then I think there's something really approachable to this concept, I think, for just about anyone, because I think we all have that sense of being out of place. There's this great presentation by eBay's first, and I believe now former chief diversity officer, Damian Hooper Campbell, where he shows the audience a picture of a child alone on a play field, hugging their knees into their chest. And I think we all have a sense of the exclusion and loneliness that that child is feeling. It's a really powerful and visceral image. And for me, that's what's at the heart of DE&I and inclusive leadership work in general. It's about making sure that no one is experiencing that kind of isolation in the workplace. It's, I think, what a lot of people in this work are trying to solve for when we talk about the importance of belonging. So with all that context and all that said, I'd love to hear a bit from you, Ruchika. How do you personally experience this concept of being a third culture kid?
Julian, such a great question. And I realize that I haven't had a chance to really talk about this for many years, but I think about it all the time. And I, of mm-hmm. course, think about it much more now that I am raising a brown Indian American mm-hmm. Singaporean son here in Seattle in the United States. So I think when I think about being a third culture kid, there was a very strong sense of being from an Indian family, and not only from an Indian family and growing up in a home that was Indian, but actually from a very specific part of India, which has right. its own culture, which is something that, you know, of course, India is a huge country, mm-hmm. true diversity like I've never seen before. And sometimes people very much miss that nuance. So for me at home, it was very specific. Like we are Indian. We're from this part of India. We're going to eat Indian food. And this was very much part of like my very early formative years. In fact, my mom actually has a funny story about how when I started kindergarten in Singapore, because I was so acculturated to speaking Hindi at home, that my teachers actually thought I'd never really be able to learn English. So the fact oh, wow. that I then went on to get a master's in journalism is, you know, in English, and right. is something that always makes everyone laugh. So that was one part of my identity. Then the second part of the identity is being from Singapore, which is definitely a melting pot, but certainly when I was growing up there in the 90s, it was still a very Asian, right? And being Asian, mm-hmm. different parts of the Southeast Asian culture was a very deep sort of part of being Singaporean. So there was that. And then the third part of my identity, which really tells you how confused and how sort of moving between all the worlds was very, you know, interesting and challenging, is my early education was actually in a British school. So very British, you know, really, really built for kids who had moved from England and were going to move back to England at some point when their parents' contracts to be in Singapore mm-hmm. were up. So that was very early experience. And then moving to an international school, which was supposed to be more sort of reflective of the diversity of different experiences, but still very Western. So it was interesting to kind of side by side, on the one hand, grow up with a very sort of strong Indian identity at home, speak Hindi, Indian food, the religion, et cetera, et cetera. And then on the other, have a very sort of Western education upbringing. And I actually have a very funny, weird question to ask you, Julian.
Yes, please.
This is something that came to mind. So before our conversation, I went to the dentist and actually wanted to ask my dentist this question. I didn't get a chance. So in India and in Indian households, we brush our teeth. I promise there's a point to this. We brush our teeth when we wake up, before you eat anything, before you drink anything, before you certainly have any breakfast. And that's mm-hmm. very much rooted in Ayurvedic practices.
Yep.
And all my Indian friends, when I would have my sleepovers as a kid, speaking of third culture kids, that's what I would do, and nobody would bat an eyelid, and that's how you did it. But when I went to visit and have sleepovers at any of my Western friends' homes, you know, any of my European friends or American friends, they would brush their teeth after breakfast. So something really, I just want to give an example of something right. that's very small and benign, right? There are many much more, you know, important examples that I could give, but here's a very benign example of how those differences, like truly your worldview is rooted in this one thing that for a part of your life, you're like, everyone does it this mm-hmm. way. And then suddenly, as you grow a little bit older, you're like, oh no, there's a whole wide swath of people who do it a very different
right.
So anyway, I just wanted to share that example.
Well, I feel like now I've got to answer the question.
You got to answer.
I brush my teeth. well, and I'll say as a parent of three young kids, like never enough. You know, like that's like the kind of like never as much as like the dentist wants you to brush their teeth. You know, but definitely every night and most mornings. And I do it before breakfast, partially because I know about the kind of like the Ayurvedic thought process behind it, having spent a little bit of time in India, but also because I did a research on what's better in terms of like drinking coffee. And wow. what I understand is that if you brush your teeth, this is not related to D&I, but this is going to be probably the,
I
might
be
the most important thing.
People should hear this conversation.
that if you brush before coffee, you're removing things that would otherwise like make the coffee stain your teeth more. So if you brush mm-hmm. before you have coffee in the morning, as opposed to after, but you probably could do both and that'd be optimal. before and after.
Too much effort, I would say.
Right. But I love that example. I think, cause it is, you're right. It is benign. There's not a, it's a pretty low bar to like an honest conversation. But I think there are lots of examples like that of, you know, you and I both were talking too about like, we both spent some time abroad visiting family this summer. And there were like a couple of times where like, we made meals for people while we were there. And like, just like, you know, there's like stuff that I match up. We had with my dad, we had grilled sausages one night and potato salad. And we made also like a green salad. And he was like, why do you have two salads? Like these two dressings are not complementary to one another. And I was like, because we wanted something green to eat, you know? And you're just like, but he's like, well, sausage and potato salad is a complete meal. Like you need nothing else. And I'm like, okay, great. You know? And so let's move on. But I think for me, the thing that, you know, more than anything is, you know, you talked about how sometimes people, you say, oh, I'm from Singapore. And people are like, they don't even like want to wager a guess at where that is. Like they don't want to show that they don't know. And so they just kind of like avoid it or ignore it. For me, people are like, oh, Switzerland, that's great. So you all speak Swedish then? Or like, you know, that's for me, that's like the common one is like, or attributing Swedish fish to the Swiss. And I'm just like, you know. So once in a gas station, I saw red Swiss fish candy, which was really exciting to me because I felt like finally, here are the fish. Everybody that's been, you know, asking about the Swedish fish, that these are the ones they're talking about.
That's amazing. That is amazing. And I think this is so important from a DEI context, because what happens, especially to third culture kids that I've spoken to and a little bit of the research I've seen, is in trying to fit those boxes, you really don't bring your authentic self to work. It's just very hard because sometimes you yourself don't know what that authentic self is. And of course, as you grow older, you develop it, which anyway happens with, you know, development in your life. But I think this is really important for global leaders, for organizations to know that there are going to be people in your workforce who come in with multiple cultures. And it doesn't just have to be third culture kids like us. It could be, you know, kids who have immigrant parents. And you truly have to code switch sometimes multiple times a day with multiple different types of people. And it takes a toll on you. And if you don't feel supported and like you can bring who you are into that work context, which is, as we know, a really big part of our lives, wherever you live, you know, we're not really bringing our full, you know, the power, we're not unleashing the power of who we are when we come into the workforce.
Yeah. And I think one thing I think too, that's important to recognize is that, it, you know, there's these chosen, unchosen identity points, and there's these visible and invisible identity points. And this is an example of one of those unchosen invisible, right? Where like you can't see it. You know, you can see certain identity points, but this one you can't see. And I think it is, and everybody relates to it, I think, differently. But I think it is really important. And it's formative in a way that I think it just sticks with you. You know, you don't, and I think that's, for me, that's been something that that's been interesting, is just, I'm always like, you know, this will eventually feel 100% like home. You know, and I think I've been telling myself that for, you know, 20 plus, you know, more than 20 years now, right? You always have a foot out, you know?
Yeah.
And a connection, like there's a connection to like a place, a route that's really far away.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. I really hear you on that. And again, for, you know, even bringing this back to our DEI conversation, the reality is, for inclusive leaders, there needs to be space to understand that so many of us do operate, you know, like that. Again, you could be a third culture kid, maybe you're not, and maybe you have immigrant parents or whatnot, but it is really important for us to feel supported in that. I remember years ago, I was working for a company and I wanted to go home to Singapore. And I really felt the pressure to work through part of my trip home, right? And that's because the vacation time was, you know, 4 days here, 4 days there. And many people who have family in the United States, for them, that's ideal. Or, you know, at least it's not so much of a pressure to have to go home and back in 4 days. But for me, it was really stressful. And I remember that being one of a very, very key moments where I really thought, you know, again, because I have the privilege to, but I really thought, you know, is this what I want to do? Is this the sort of tenterhooks that I want to live on? You know, I really felt like I was living on the edge. I was like, you know, God forbid, like if I need to get home overnight and be there for a couple of weeks or whatever it is, do I have the safety to do that? And the reality is I didn't.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. Yeah. Well, by way of introduction to Switzerland, did you know, Ruchika, that Switzerland is the Singapore of Europe? And if you detected any sarcasm, a snark in that comment, there's a good measure of it there, because I've heard so many times about a number of countries. So Singapore is the Switzerland of Southeast Asia.
Yes.
Panama is the Switzerland of Central America, apparently. And I've been in both those places, and I just, when people like heard that from me, and not just, you know, folks that look like me, not just white folks, but even people there would be like, you know, they look, it's like a, just kind of like a classic example of like whitewashing, is just saying like this one place is like this other place. And I think it illustrates, you know, one of the central distinctions that you try, and it gets us into this conversation, but a distinction that you try and draw between cultural competency and cultural humility. So for me, competency is like saying, oh, like I know this thing so well, I'm going to like displace it and I'm going to, you know, I'm going to frame it up in this particular way. Whereas humility would be more, you know, looking for what's distinct and unique and special about that place in and of itself, instead of trying to say, oh, well, it's like this other place because of its size, because of its military service, because of its financial, you know, there may be parallels and similarities, but the reasons for those, I'm sure, are very distinct and unique. And asking questions about that, I think, can really get to, you know, things of real interest. So I'd love the soapbox to be yours. Love to hear you tell us a little bit more about that challenge between those two things and centering it for leaders in particular.
Yeah. Thank you. And Julian, I want to actually put the concept of, or the distinction between cultural competency and cultural humility squarely with where it belongs, which is largely with Black social justice leaders here in the United States that were finding that a lot of especially nonprofits and also the healthcare system that was serving communities of color had that sort of cultural competency versus cultural humility, you know, approach to serving the people that they were supposed to be serving, and actually with very negative and disastrous consequences. And so social justice leaders in those communities really turned around and said, you know, rather than cultural competency training, rather than, you know, having people just sort of scratch the surface. And as you, this is a great example of, you know, this country is like this country, or this society is like this other Western way of doing things, or, you know, essentially it centers the dominant group's way of doing things as the best way, and upholds that as the best way. Rather than doing that, it's more important to really stop and take stock of and be flexible about the different ways that our different cultures operate without making assumptions. Again, I want to use a benign example to demonstrate how important it can be. So when people look at me, again, I present as an Indian woman. So the first thing people will say to me, you know, are you vegetarian, or do you love Indian food? Do you cook a lot of Indian food? And what folks don't realize is, again, my invisible identity of being Singaporean is such an important part of whom I identify as. So when I think of comfort food, I think of congee, or I think of noodles, or I think of fried rice, you know, more Chinese style and Chinese influenced food rather than Indian food, because for me that, you know, was a very important part of my identity. So again, cultural competency would look at me and say, oh, she looks like other Indian people. So therefore, I remember when I spoke to another Indian person, or when I watched a program about them on TV, this is what they like. And then for me, and then instead, cultural humility would say, tell me more about you. You know, what type of food do you like to eat? Or, you know, do you like to cook? What type of food do you like to cook? That sort of, that little nuance. And this, again, I'm using a benign example. It's really important to then, when you think about people, when you take an intersectional approach to DEI, when you think about people you meet in the workforce, again, it's that difference between saying to someone, oh, is your husband going to be joining us at this party, rather than saying, you know, oh, who else have you brought to this party? You know, and it could be, again, it could be, you know, rather than you making that statement because you assume that everyone is heterosexual like yourself, for example, you kind of give more space and time and curiosity.
Yeah, I love that, because I think it's, you know, there's this like, there's an opportunity in having respect for individuality and each individual's uniqueness. And I think we recognize ourselves that none of us are, you know, no group is a monolith, right? I had a conversation a couple of weeks back where we're talking about the fact that there's 1.8 billion Muslims in the world, you know? So like there's, so making any assumptions based on one person or two people or three people that you meet who might identify with a particular identity group is always going to get you in, you know, it's just always going to get you in trouble. Because there's just no, so I think better questions, if you're actually invested in, if you're a leader and you're actually invested in knowing your people well, you will learn to ask better questions.
And observe,
right? And listen. Yeah.
And listen and observe. I mean, the subtle cues. And again, that is what, you know, to your point of how third culture kids often make excellent leaders and are, you know, just have the competencies, which I know we were going to talk about too, but the competencies of inclusive leadership. Many of us have it because we know what it's like to walk into the room, not have our viewpoint represented or certainly not represented fully, and sort of take a beat before whether we start talking or whether we start engaging, to pick up on those subtle cues, which is really important to be an inclusive leader.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. So, well, you introduced it. So when we think about organizations, everybody wants to measure stuff, you know, things, everything has to be measured. So what does, in your experience, what does cultural humility look like as a competency? And it's, if it is something that we can measure, what are some ideas or ways in which like you've seen it measured effectively?
You know, one thing that is uncomfortable and so necessary, and I would actually say extremely necessary in every part of the world. I even see this when I go back to Singapore. Mm-hmm. It's more organizations working to literally address, to look at, assess, and then address where white supremacy culture and the culture of professionalism, which we know, which again, research and scholars have found is linked very much to whiteness as an mm-hmm. ideal, as the best way to do things, and address that and try and undo it and find sort of the people who can really lead that charge and be willing to engage in that work, I think is really important. And of course, it's uncomfortable, and it does mean being really creative, both humble, but also really creative, right? So if we think about as punctuality as the number one, for example, a professional skill, right? And this is something we really value at this organization. What does it look like to find alternatives or make sure that your employees and even leaders who, you know, come from cultures where maybe where punctuality doesn't necessarily equate professionalism, mm-hmm. how do you make room for that? And how can you be a little more creative about that? And I think these are the nuances as we really do deep DEI work, right? It's not an easy measure of, oh, let us look at our diversity numbers and our demographics and set targets. That's all really important, certainly. But when you're talking about cultural humility, you're really measuring something that in many ways is intangible. And I would argue, as more DEI practitioners say, some of our bias towards, and I am very much in this category, our bias of trying to measure and be data-driven, which, as I said, I really am in this category, is also in many ways us upholding the standards of professionalism and white supremacy culture. There are things that you can't measure. There are, and in many instances, anecdotal evidence and those stories and cultures of storytelling are just as powerful as being able to look at the numbers and say, oh, we shifted from here to here, and therefore mm-hmm. that's a success.
Yeah. Yeah. It feels there are related behavior. While you may not be able to measure that, you know, cultural humility per se, there are certainly, I'm sure, related behaviors around good listening and good questions. And, you know, and I think part of what I heard you saying is if you address effectively the culture of white supremacy in an organization, or just even if that sometimes can be like a non-starter for a productive conversation yes. with certain, organizations. But just like, even like the way things have been done, and you start asking questions and show ways in which things could be done better. If you remove some of the mass at the center, some of the systemic yes. issues, you make space for better questions. And I mean, there's lots of, there's just so many frameworks around, you know, whether it's design thinking or polarity management, or just ways in which we can think about asking better questions and filling, you know, there are things to fill the space up with when you say, what could we do differently? Or like, you know, anyway.
Yes. And again, when we relate it to questions and cultural humility, it's also giving space for different leaders to lead. Mm-hmm. And truly that means not only deferring to people in dominant groups to be the ones who do the asking of questions or set the agenda, mm-hmm. right? So It definitely requires a shift in thinking. And again, for me as well, growing up in a formerly colonized nation, I know we're talking a lot about colonialism right now, mm-hmm. in a formerly colonized nation that actually really looks upon colonialism rather kindly, you know, right. If you go around Singapore, you will see, you know, some of our most beautiful, truly beautiful institutions are marketed as, oh, this colonial style architecture or whatnot. So there's a lot of work to be done. And that internal oppression is also real, right? Again, right. My work is never pointing to an individual and saying, oh, you come from dominant group culture and therefore you're bad and you need to change. And the way I am is perfect, right? A lot of my work also focuses on what are the ways that I've been, you know, oppressed, and what are the ways that I have also oppressed others? And that's mm-hmm. a really hard thing to navigate. That's where cultural humility really comes in.
Right. Well, it seems like exposure therapy is one of the key ways to create experiences that engender humility. But realistically, we can't all spend extended periods of time traveling internationally. There's obviously real privilege in the ability to do that sure. to begin with. So practically speaking, organizations offer things like ERGs or BRGs, book clubs, professional development opportunities, even international positions or opportunities internationally if they're global. So beyond the more traditional offerings, what are some other ways you'd recommend that leaders build cultural humility themselves?
This is such a great question. And I was actually working with a very global client recently who asked this question: how do we ensure that we don't place all the labor on the people and the organizations we right. work with, in especially countries that unfortunately have been mostly, in most cases, formally colonized? And so how do we not put the onus on folks there to tell us how to improve or become more culturally competent and certainly humble and display humility? So a couple of things that I recommended in that case was one of the things I actually wrote about it in my book, Inclusion on Purpose, is the research around how reading fiction from communities that have experienced oppression and, you know, about the, you know, and it could be, again, the experiences of experiencing oppression, but also, you know, I'm all about the radical act of rest and joy and all of those great things as well that our various communities have achieved and done as well. And so reading fiction, theater, really looking for those experiences that won't make you feel defensive. And again, research shows that to be a more empathetic leader, to really develop empathy and cultural humility, it is important to consume fiction, again, by someone from that community. So I think mm-hmm. that's one thing that's really important. The other is, back to asking great questions, asking just folks within communities rather than, again, putting the labor on them. What does it feel like to be part of this community? Tell me more. Is ask them for book and podcast and video and TV show recommendations. And I think that is something that can really help build both humility, but also empathy, right? And again, mm-hmm. getting recommendations from people from those communities can really help you develop that as a key skill. Because I know a lot of what we see right now is still, whether it's, you know, this book is the New York Times bestseller, or this book by, you know, an author from a different country is really well regarded, or this TV show in a different language won an award. We still know that the people who make those decisions largely are still dominant group people. But if you mm-hmm. ask someone who is from the community, who are you reading? Who are you listening to? Where do you get your news from? I think that is really key to building the skill.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the good news is that there's, you know, there's just massive amounts of content there. There's yes. just so much out there to connect with. And I mean, there's, you know, you could watch Indian television from the comfort of your home in the US yes. and just, you know, like,
I love it.
You know, so it is like a really, you know, of the, there are certainly things about globalization that are challenging. But that is one of the gems of it, is that we can really transport ourselves, Yeah, in really interesting ways. And
food is, you know, being right. A foodie, I would be remiss if I didn't say...
plug food. You got to plug food.
Got to plug food, again, owned by people from that community, you know, restaurants. Mm-hmm. For a lot of, especially here in the United States, a lot of our immigrant, especially, you know, groups beforehand really came to this country and, you know, sharing food was really a lifeline in many, many ways.
Right.
I'll always go out of my way, especially during the pandemic, really going out of my way to support immigrant people of color owned restaurants. Mm-hmm. And it's delicious and it's wonderful. And it also, again, really helps build a lot more humility. Again, if you go in with that, you know, with an openness, with curiosity, with observation, you know, that it can make such a big difference.
Wonderful. Thank you. So this is Inclusion Catalyst. So I've got to ask, what's one example of something you've seen an organization do recently that's really catalyzing change and greater inclusion?
It's such a great question. And there are very many different things. I think the one that will always give me a lot of hope, and, you know, again, this is why I named my book Inclusion on Purpose, not trying to plug my book, right. But the thing
but
that
you should.
Well, you know, again, this being socialized, right? And this is a whole different conversation for another mm-hmm. day, but being socialized in a culture where you don't really talk about yourself, and then to have to talk right. about myself and my wonderful book is very much against any grain of like comfort for me. Mm-hmm. But what I've seen is, again, a lot more leaders, people from dominant groups, people who have privilege, including people like myself, really stepping up and taking that personal responsibility and accountability for inclusion and change, right? And that can, again, be, let me engage with a book, not because my organization recommended it as part of the book club, but I actually sought it out on my own because I believe that it's going to make me a better leader. So that's something that I, you know, and we talk about it as an organization. I'm thinking about individual leaders doing that. But what I'm also seeing, which is exciting, is more organizations slowly linking inclusion to being a key leadership trait, to mm-hmm. something that they really try and seek in their leaders. And that gives me a lot of hope. I'm, you know, at the end of the day, I am still a very glass half full, even though we are living through a global pandemic, still, I am a glass half full type of person. And so,
thank you. And finally, before we let you go, as we near the end, can you tell our listeners where they can find you online?
I'll just go with my website. If you type inclusiononpurpose.co, inclusiononpurpose.co, you will find me online.
And your wonderful book.
And my book, Inclusion on Purpose. Yeah.
Well, I've really enjoyed this conversation and our time today, Ruchika. Thanks so much for joining us and sharing your perspective, experience, and insights with our audience. That brings us to the end of this episode. Special thanks to Ruchika Tulshyan for joining us for an honest and great-hearted discussion. And thank you to our listeners for spending this time with us. We hope that you heard something of value and that it helps you to lead more inclusively. Do you know anyone that needs to hear this message? If so, be sure to click that share button. You can connect with me, Julian Geiser, and Great Heart Consulting on LinkedIn. And as always, thanks for listening to Inclusion Catalyst.
Thank you, Julian.
Thank you.
You can bring your stories to the table as a partner and a host on the Inclusion Catalyst podcast. Visit inclusioncatalyst.com and click the link that says join us as a guest host.
And that's it for this episode of Inclusion Catalyst. If you enjoyed it, please subscribe and share with your friends and colleagues.